Good afternoon, everybody. Now, I'm going to ask the sound person, Brad, if I actually walk around this room a lot, is there going to be a horrible squeal of feedback that's going to get us all in the hospital? So I can actually, even though I am amplified, I can walk around the room. That's a beautiful thing, because that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to spend as little time up here today, because this isn't about me being up here. This is actually about us all together, and I'm going to try to put that into practice. The first thing I'm going to do, and I hate to do this, Roy, but I need to amend something that you said. Roy asked you to turn your mobiles down or off. I'm asking you to do exactly the opposite today, because every time a mobile should ring, it will be a reminder to us of what we're talking about today. So I'm going to start off with a story. And the story happens nearly half a billion seconds ago. It's 1997, it's August, and I am here on my very first trip to Australia. I was asked to come out and speak at an Internet World conference, because that was when the Internet was so shiny and new that people had conferences about the Internet. And I was here, and I spoke, and I actually had some friends in Australia, people who had come over and visited me in America, and I was excited that I was coming to visit them. And I called them, and they said, great, we're going to go out to dance, we're going to go out drinking, we're going to have some dinner. I said, excellent. Where do we meet? He said, well, you're down in Darling Harbor. That's where you're staying. There's a great big IMAX cinema over in Darling Harbor. I want you to meet us in front of the IMAX cinema at 6:30. Done. So the day comes. I get myself down to the IMAX cinema, and I'm sitting in front of the IMAX cinema, and I'm looking at my watch. It's 6:30, and there's four of my friends, and I'm expecting 10 people. And it's 6:30, and it's 6:31, and it's 6:32, and it's 6:33, and I don't really know what we should do here, because I'm faced with this eternal problem, which is that if you've arranged to meet your friends at a certain place and at a certain time and they don't show up, what do you do? Do you wait for them, or do you simply go on, and then the party is never really together for the rest of the night? And as I'm sitting and wondering about what to do with this problem, because I haven't seen these people, and I'm going to be flying home, and I won't see them again, one of my friends pulls out a mobile, calls the other group of friends, and says, we'll meet you down on Oxford Street. Now, by the time I got to Australia in 1997, half of all Australians owned a mobile. Australia is basically the first place in the world where half of the population owned a mobile. Now, I had come from this weird antique land known as the United States of America, where in 1997, barely one-fifth of the population owned a mobile, and I actually didn't buy my first mobile until 1999. But here's something interesting. When half the population has a mobile, you start to expect that you can actually reach people pretty much any time you want just by pulling your own mobile out and dialing their number. And that expectation becomes part of your behavior. It becomes part of your understanding of how the world works. And as your understanding changes, your behavior begins to change. And so calling your friends when they aren't where they're supposed to be at the time they're supposed to be there, it's not something we even bother mentioning in 2012. It's sort of beneath our awareness. Oh, a text came in. Oh, he's going to be 10 minutes late. Oh, all right. But that same thing that's completely just like normal, it was rare and magical and inconceivable 15 years ago. But today, everyone knows where everyone else is, more or less, if they want to be found. It's all very easy, it's all very seamless, it's all completely immediate. And we like that power. We have grown accustomed to having that kind of power. It's grown into us. It's grown underneath our skin. I want you to think for a minute about the last time you left your mobile at home. And you didn't realize it for a while, and then you reached for it, and all of a sudden, oh dear, oh dear, oh no. How did you feel in that moment? You felt a little cut off. You felt a little separate. You almost felt like part of you was missing. And every time you went through the day and you were reminded of the fact that you didn't have your mobile with you, you kind of felt a little tug. It's almost like the phantom pain of an amputated limb. Until at the end of the day, you and your mobile were happily reunited. All was forgiven. And that's because the mobile is now part of us. It has now worked its way beneath our skin. I remember giving an early version of this talk a few years ago, and a woman came up to me afterwards. She said, "I cannot wait until I can have a mobile implanted." And I turned to her and said, "How many hours of a day is your mobile more than 1 meter away from your body?" And she thought about it for a minute, and she said, "Never." "Why do you need it implanted?" And so this need, this connection, it's changed us. It's changed us immensely. In some ways, we are unrecognizable to the folks back in 1980, as Roy pointed out. And this transformation has been happening right in front of our eyes. Another little story. Two really good friends. They were a couple. They were a couple in business, and they were a couple in life. And they traveled everywhere together. They spun fire, and they taught other people how to spin fire, and they were very, very good at it. And they went around the world, and they had this wonderful relationship. And then, as my friend said, then he got a BlackBerry. And then they would travel the world all the time with him going, "I'm listening. I'm listening." And she said, and it wasn't really quite the same because we were together, but he was somewhere else, listening. And she said, and then there was a trip, and we got invited to go to Peru. And we got off the plane in Peru, and there was no mobile coverage. And it was like I had him back again. We have become so connected that we're actually pulling away from the people who are right there in front of us. Let me show you the default social posture in 2012. When out in public, this is who we are. I snapped that the day before yesterday, so it's fresh. We are staring down and staring into our little connected worlds. And it's not just about the grown-ups here who are doing this. I teach regularly at Sydney University, and one time a year I get to teach a big class filled with about 150 students. And I start that class off, because it's a nice long lecture, and I survey the students about when they got their first mobile phone. And so their average age in this class is around 20 years old. And when I asked them last August, they said on average they'd gotten their first mobile phone when they were 11 and a half years old. Now remember, that means that that happened almost 10 years ago. And that that's no longer the case. Another little story about my sister. My sister lives in San Diego. She has two lovely children, my nephews, who are 10 and 9 years old. They go to primary school. The primary school is about 5 kilometers from home. They take the bus or someone drives them. Well, one day, they were supposed to be picked up and driven home from school, but because some message got lost in translation between my sister, my brother-in-law, and my father, who would normally all handle these tasks, the kids were simply waiting at school. Finally, my younger nephew, who's quite, I think, perhaps both intelligent and a go-getter, adventurous, says to my older nephew, "Let's walk home." And so they do. And somewhere in here, my sister realizes that the children have not been picked up and that they are not at school. And so she goes in the car looking for them, and she finds them walking along the side of the El Camino Real, which is sort of San Diego's version of Parramatta Road. Only it doesn't really have a footpath. My nephew's got mobiles the next day. And of course, that's a perfectly normal pattern. We need to be connected. We need to connect the kids so the kids can be safe. And it's not just true in California, and it's not just true for the parents. I'm good friends with a woman named Genevieve Bell. Genevieve Bell is an anthropologist who works for Intel, the person who makes the computer chips in all of our computers in the world. And she goes out and she talks to people all over the world, and she spent a week in a classroom in South Korea, primary age kids. And the Koreans had given their kids mobiles, fine, with GPS, so that the parents could always know where the kids were. And Genevieve was asking the kids how they felt about the fact that the parents always knew where they were. And the kids said, see that kid over there? Yes. She doesn't have one of these phones. Her parents don't love her as much. So the kids don't equate this constant awareness with surveillance, but with love, with care. That's what it is. Now, I'm talking about things that happen in the world that we're familiar with the developed world. This is actually not the main event. It has changed our lives immensely. I will talk more about how it's changing them. But this, Australia, America, Europe, South Korea, we are not the main event. Compared to what's going on in the rest of the world, we are insignificant. I'm going to tell you 3 stories which will help you understand how insignificant we are. The first of these happens in Kerala. Kerala is the South Indian Ocean coast. Well, on that South Indian Ocean coast, there have been fishermen fishing for thousands of years. They go out in the morning, they throw their nets over the side, they say a prayer, they pull it up, they get their catch in. When they have their catch in their boats again, they are faced with a question. Where do I sell my fish that day? There are fish markets up and down the Kerala coast. So they're going to make a decision. They're going to pull into one port or another. Trouble is, some other fisherman is going to have made exactly the same decision and have pulled the boat into the same port. And all of a sudden, there's a fishing port that has too many fish. And fish have to be sold right away. Not a lot of refrigeration in Kerala. So you've got to get it in there, you've got to get it to the market, and you've got to sell it. And if there's too many fish, you're going to be able to sell your catch for what other people are going to pay, which is not a lot of money. Meanwhile, there's another fishing port 5 km away, just up the coast, and no fishermen pulled in that day, and there's no fish in that port available at any price. And that's the way it had always been in Kerala for thousands of years. And then in 1997, the Indian government deregulated the telecoms industry, and mobile phone towers popped up all across India. And you don't need to get any clearances to pop up a mobile phone tower in India. So they really do pop up everywhere. And they popped up all along the seashore. And it turns out that when you put them against the seashore, not only do you give everyone on the beach great mobile reception, but it goes out to sea about 20 km till it falls off the curvature of the earth. Now, mobiles in 1997 in Kerala were incredibly expensive. They basically cost as much as a fisherman would earn in a single month. But there must have been a rich fisherman somewhere. He got a phone. He brought it to sea. And when he was out at sea, he got a call from land. Maybe during the course of this call from land, he found out that there was a port that needed fish that day. And there's the call. And as soon as he found out, he set sail, he goes to that port, he makes a really good income on his catch that day. The next day he's out to sea, and what does he do? He doesn't wait for the call, he makes the call. And he finds out which port needs fish that day. And he does it the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and all of a sudden he's making a lot of money because he's always making the right decision. And all of the other fishermen figure out really quickly why this is happening, and bing, bang, boom, they all have mobiles as well. And within a year's time, every fisherman in Kerala now has a mobile. They are now all earning so much more money that the mobile, which cost them a month's income, can now be paid off in 2 months from the extra income that they're earning. Every market has fish. Every market has fish at a good market price. That's example number one. Example number two, Kenya. If you are a farmer in Kenya and you have your produce and you're ready to sell your produce, what do? Well, you sort of load it up in the cart and you go to the market and you sell your produce at the market. But what happens if all the other farmers around have decided they're going to sell exactly the same produce in the market that day? There's an oversupply and oops, you're not getting even what you need to subsist upon. Instead, what you do now is you take your little mobile phone out of your pocket. You send a text message to a service called Drumnet saying, this is what I'm selling. Give me the prices for this in all of the markets around me. And then you pick the market that has the best price. You head off there, and you earn 40% more than you used to for the same amount of work. Example three, Karachi. Barbers are very popular in Karachi. But in order to be a barber in Karachi, you had to rent a stall in the marketplace, which is expensive, and customers had to come to you. Now what happens is you buy yourself a bicycle, and you buy yourself a mobile, and you print up a whole bunch of signs saying, would you like your haircut? Call me. And then you ride to your customers, and you cut their hair in the comfort of their own homes. And everyone wins, and you don't have to pay a lot for a stall in the market. The customer gets care when they want. And you have a business. The mobile, the thing that we kind of think, oh, it's really nice, makes life a little easier. The mobile is the most important tool for wealth creation since the metal axe head. And this point has not been lost on anyone to whom it matters. Because people might be poor, but they are not stupid. And so when one person in one village comes home with a mobile, and everyone in that village watches how that person uses that mobile to bring work and wealth to the person who owns it, well, there's a penny drop moment, and pretty soon everyone in that village all at once buys a mobile. And this is why, as of this month, there are 1 billion mobile subscribers in China. There are 700 million mobile subscribers in India. There are 600 million mobile subscribers in Africa. On a planet with just barely over 7 billion people, 6 billion mobile subscribers. There will be more mobile devices than people on the planet by the end of this year. And if trends persist, by 2016, every single person on Earth will have a mobile. Every person will be connected. Every person will be accessible to every other person, and it won't just be the old and the rich. Another story. October the 13th, 2003 is the day that I arrived in Australia. Long plane flight from Los Angeles. I'm moving here for at least a little while. It turned out the rest of my life, but it was at least a little while. I'm met at the airport by my friend Shiloh. She picks me up. We get in the car. And the first thing we do, before I go and get my apartment, before we go and get to go to IKEA to get the few things that I'm going to need to live, the first thing that we do is we go to Parramatta Phones and we get me a mobile. Because, as she put it, if you don't have a mobile in Australia, you don't exist. And that's not just true in Australia. Before another half billion seconds pass, humans are going to be receiving their first mobile as they emerge from the womb, because it's going to be embedded in the tag that nurse just slipped over their foot. It's going to be keeping track of their temperature and their respiration and their heartbeat. It's going to be keeping them connected. It's going to be keeping them closer to us. Now, come down off the podium. We find it very, very hard to keep quiet. We like to talk. We like to communicate. Well, whatever happens to be on our mind. And it's a good thing that we do that, because I want you to stretch your mind back a million years to think about why it might be a good idea that we communicate. A million years ago, all of our ancestors all lived somewhere in Africa. And when they saw something, it might have been food, it might have been a lion, it might have been a bushfire, but when they saw something, they would have said something about it. Now, a million years ago, we didn't talk the way we do now, but they would have made it completely clear to everyone else around what was going on. And when they did that, everyone else would know, and then they would be able to act from that knowledge. That's the essence of communication, is communicating something you know to someone else so they can act on it. And they could take advantage of the food that's there, or they could save themselves from the lion. And here's the thing. The people who could do that the best, the people who could share what they knew with other people and could get that point so clearly across that the other people knew how to act on it, those people stood a better chance against the lions and against the fires. They stood a better chance of finding food. They would make the most of their opportunities because they were sharing those opportunities. And so those people would thrive, and their children would thrive. And the way that they shared what they knew was essential to their success. And because it was essential to their success, it would get passed down generation after generation after generation until it was taken for granted, until people simply didn't think about it, until it was just part of us. So we're sharing beings. That's actually part of the basic job description of being human. We do not need to be taught to share. Not that kind of sharing. We don't need to be taught to share our experience. We simply do it. Whenever we connect to one another, that's our overwhelming first instinct. It's to share. And just this right now, here, 2012. We are connected to everybody everywhere. Now, when people connect in the flesh, or when they connect over the mobile, it doesn't really matter. They do precisely the same thing. They share. Okay, fine. What do we share? Well, we start off both as small children and as people who maybe are newbies online, people who have just gone online. Small children and newbies online share everything. There's no filter. So if you think about it, if you ask a four-year-old what's happening and they trust you, well, you'd better be prepared for a long story because they're just going to start sharing. And the same thing, of course, is true when people first go online. I'm not going to name any names, but they share every joke. They share every photo of a kitten. They share every internet chain letter. We've seen this from our family and our friends. We might even have done it once ourselves. And it annoys people. After all, the content of communication is supposed to be important. It's supposed to be something that I can act on. It should have some sort of meaning to me. At least if you want me to pay any attention to it. And this assault of whatever coming my way because you've just discovered the internet does not cut it. And so you get a little bit annoyed. And you tell the person, back off. All right, look, I don't need to see every piece of anything that you find online. Or, on the other hand, and again, I'm not going to name names, perhaps you love cute little pictures of kittens. And so when your friend sends one through, you respond gratefully. Perhaps you even have some of your own and you share them with that person. And so, as that person shares with you, some connections are made stronger around some things, and some connections are made weaker around other things. One person loves kittens, hates politics, that's most of us in the room right now. Another person loves sport, doesn't want to talk about the stock market. Another person wants to hear all of the gossip about your mutual friends. Horses for courses. Each connection and each relationship is unique. And we aren't born knowing who likes what. We have to learn that, and we learn that by trial and error. We learn that by sharing and figuring out whether people like what we're sharing. And the memory of what we share with people becomes the substance of the relationship. And we've always done exactly this since we learned to share. We've always shared with each other, and inside of that sharing, that's how we shape the bonds of relationship. Now, these relationships live in our heads. They live in the memories of likes and dislikes. And that means that actually in each of our heads, we're carrying miniature versions of all of the people that we're connected with. All the time. I want you to consider. You're sitting and watching the telly. Perhaps you're watching the news and you see a really significant report on the telly. Who knows what it's about? It's exciting or it's funny or it's infuriating. And in the moment that your blood pressure rises, you think, oh, I reckon Nick would really like to see this. And you know that because you know Nick. And you know Nick because you've shared with Nick. And Nick's shared with you. And it was automatic. You didn't have to think about it. You just knew. Oh, yeah, Nick will love that. And that's how you know that Nick is in your head. And that's going to be true for your family. That's going to be true for your friends. That's going to be true probably for a number of your coworkers and your neighbors. Anyone you care enough to share with. Maybe not often, but share with often enough that the memory of what you share about doesn't fade. But we're limited here. It's not possible to know everyone. Now, we can remember a lot because human beings have capacious memories, but remembering people and all the specifics of people actually really difficult. It takes a lot of work. It actually takes a lot of brain capacity. And 20 years ago, an anthropologist by the name of Robin Dunbar worked out that the number of people that we can know this well is around 150. That's it. Ain't gonna be any better than that. Yes, you can know more people than that, but you won't know them well enough to have that aha moment of sharing. And of course, that doesn't mean that you can't share with them, because we're all connected. And so we can share with anybody, anywhere, all the time. And so actually now, we face the prospect, the real immediate prospect of drowning in all of this sharing, of all of this stuff, which is mostly meaningless to us. There are just a little few flakes of gold here and there in the mountain of all of this dross. And it's not dross to someone else, but it's dross to us because it's not something we're interested in. And in order to put a firewall around ourselves from the crazy overshare that is humanity in 2012, we have built systems for us that block the flow. You know what those systems are called? Social networks. We think we have social networks to help us share better. That's certainly exactly what Mark Zuckerberg thought when he started Facebook. But really, the opposite is true. We need to block the noise. We need to focus on what's important. And we need to do that on a planet where a few billion people could suddenly decide that they all want to share with us. And so we actually use Facebook to stop the noise. So instead of letting everything in, what these digital social networks do is they allow us to connect and share in great numbers, but at every step along the way, there's a person deciding whether something is interesting enough to pass along, to share with a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of you. And by the time it's gotten through all those friends, there ain't a whole lot getting through. So we're all already 6 billion of us entirely connected. But each of us stands in the way of the others. We are blocking the flow that would overwhelm us. And thank goodness for that. Now, filters can reinforce our prejudices. There's no question. A filter can reinforce your ignorance. It can reinforce your stupidity. But it also means that we can function in a world where we are connected to 6 billion other people. Okay. Everyone is sharing. Everyone is sharing everything all the time. So much sharing is going on everywhere. That although the social networks look like information conduits, they're really filters. They are the blackout curtains of hyperconnectivity. But even with those blackout curtains, what manages to get through is really highly illuminating, because what gets through is being driven by what drives us, by our needs and our passions and our desires and our loves and our hates and our fascinations and our obsessions. These are the things that we move toward, either in love or fear, and these are the things that reach toward us. That filter of 6 billion individuals, it's good enough that it blocks almost anything except the thing we want. And in a real sense, the things we want now come and assault us. Because when we declare our interest in anything, and we can do that simply by a Google search now, you can do it by posting something on Facebook, you can do it any number of ways, send a text message, or just by responding positively when someone shares something with us, that's expressing an interest. Well, that interest very quickly turns into a trickle, and that trickle turns into a stream, and that stream turns into a torrent, and all of a sudden, we're lost at sea. Simply being interested in something is now all the precondition that's required to be drowning in information about it. Not because of the machines. It's because of all the people who are ceaselessly sharing. Because they care. Because sharing is caring. And now, I don't even need to go looking. All I need to do is express my interest in something, and interesting things are going to start to come and find me. They're going to be passed hand to hand to hand through the network at the speed of light filtered by 6 billion minds. So we can go from knowing nothing at all to having a fleeting interest to swimming in information in less time than it takes to make a cuppa. And this is the baseline. This is simply the way life is now in 2012. All right, that's all theory. Let's talk about what that looks like in reality. Let me see if I can tie this down to something that happened to me this week. I have to start off with a little bit of a story. 2 years ago, I quit Facebook. I quit Facebook because I didn't like sharing everything. I realized that this set of connections with other people, which Facebook calls the social graph, that it was really very potent. There's been a bunch of research that has been done that shows that behaviors spread through your connections. So that if one of your friends quits smoking, you're more likely to quit smoking. If one of your friends starts smoking, you're more likely to start smoking. If one of your friends goes on a diet or decides that they're going to pig out or gets a divorce, if you're connected to that person, it's more likely to happen to you. And I realized that this graph, which shows what's going on with my friends, I didn't want Mark Zuckerberg owning it. I wanted to take it away from him. I wanted to have it for myself because it said a lot about me. Azio can analyze my social graph and know whether I'm a terrorist, or know whether I'm a homosexual, or know whether I'm a liberal, just by analyzing my social graph. And of course, Facebook now has a billion social graphs, and that's why Facebook's now worth $100 billion. But I took it away. I closed my Facebook account. Of course, I couldn't give up social media completely. I am a compulsive Twitterer. I have sent 70,000 tweets in 6 years. I don't think I'm proud of that. And Twitter is its own social graph. It's right out there in public. And so I'm constantly sending messages over Twitter. Those of you who haven't seen it, that's what messages look like. So I was wondering if there was some way that I could obscure what I was sending on Twitter so that only the person to whom the message was aimed would be able to read it. Would there be some way that I could encrypt these messages so that they'd be completely private and no one would learn who I was having conversations with? Now, I don't know. I should say I didn't know anything about how to make this happen. But as soon as I went looking for information, I found too much good stuff. I found all of these people sharing everything they knew about how to make this happen. And so pretty soon I figured out how to create something that I called CrypTweet. And it turns those tweets into that. Just a lot of gobbledygook. And on Monday, I released it to the world. Made a very public declaration about my interest in cryptography and security and privacy. And I sent the message out to the 27,000 people who follow me on Twitter. And they took that message and they shared it out. And then they shared it out and they shared it out. And pretty soon, this little program that I'd made had found its way to everyone who was interested in Twitter and security. It did that within minutes because it went from person to person to person. And within minutes, people had taken a look at what I'd done. They'd examined the guts of it and they'd found big mistakes. Now, they're beginner mistakes. I didn't do things wrong, but I didn't do things very securely. Basically, what I'd built was a very flimsy lock. It gave the impression of security, but it was kind of easy to pick. Now, I didn't know that when I shared my work around, but because of the way sharing works in a connected world, what I shared immediately found its way to the people who would care about what I had done. And because they cared, they shared, and they told me in exquisite detail, line by line, just what I'd done wrong. And so I learned something. I'd made beginner's mistakes. I was a beginner. I'd made beginner's mistakes. But what's new here was that as I shared with them through those mistakes, it brought me into contact with the community of cryptographers that I'd known about, but I wasn't actually connected to. People who shared the same interests as me. They're much more intense about it than I am, but we share the same interests. And we share a common interest in wanting to see things being done the right way. And so at that point, this is Tuesday night, I was faced with a decision. Where did I want to take this? How deep down the rabbit hole did I want to go? Because the moment that I shared this, want it or not, I actually became part of the community of people who care about these things. And some people in that community, people like me, are absolute beginners. Some of them are world-famous experts. Most of them are in between. But by deciding to accept their help, to stay connected, to stay in relation with them, I actually know more than I did before. I know more now on Saturday than I did on Monday. I know a lot more because people have been very clear. And I will learn more. And I know where to turn when I have questions now. And so every time I do that, every time I connect, I will learn a little bit more from the experts. I will level up. And if I keep this up, after a time, I may actually know enough that I'll be able to answer someone else's beginner questions. I won't be an expert. I doubt I will ever be an expert in cryptography. But I will know enough to be able to share and care. And so the longer that I spend in connection and in community with these experts, the more expert I become. And that has always been true. That is the way anyone learns anything. But just right now, in 2012, in the age of hyper-connectivity, it's everywhere, it's immediate, and it's incredibly potent. We are now embedded deep within the human university. And if you take nothing else out of my talk today, remember that. Every one of us is now embedded in postgraduate studies in whatever subject that interests us. Could be the Rabideaus, it could be the Reserve Bank, it could be cryptography. It's all right here, it's all surrounding us, it's all part of us. And we all learn so much more than we ever did before, so quickly, so effectively, there is now no going back. Because once we know more, well, one of my favorite quotes. All knowing is doing, and all doing, knowing. What we know, we do. We don't have any choice in the matter. That just happens. And the more we know, the more we can do. So the scope of our capabilities as people, it's tied directly to what we've learned. And now, everyone everywhere, 6 billion, soon 7 billion of us, is deep inside of these sharing networks. And now everyone is sharing everything interesting with everyone else who's interested in it. And so we are able to do more and more and more, far more than we could before, and we are becoming quite powerful. And we didn't see this coming, because pretty much feels perfectly natural to us. It's just how we live life in 2012. But it's not possible for me to sort of sit around and connect and share and pretty quickly create something that will scare the crap out of a few secret organizations. And I can do that right out in public. I can do pretty much as I like. And everyone else gets the same pass. They can all work together. They can all connect and share and learn. And once they do that, they can start to throw their weight around. They can make a real splash. They can cause lots of trouble. We see tiny little examples of this. The London riots in August last year were orchestrated by people using BlackBerry Messenger so they could tell other people where the cops were and where the cops weren't, just by connecting and sharing. We saw it in Egypt in the revolution last year. Protest was spreading by text message, by Facebook, by Twitter, and it crystallized a popular revolution. And all of this, that's just the beginning. Because what I do, what really interests me, I mean, cryptography is fun, but what really interests me is how these new human networks work. That's what I study. That's what I care about. That's what I share. And I'm working on this book. And I'm sharing the chapters for this book as I write them. And I'm getting them out there to the other people who care so that we can all have a think, so that we can share what we know, so that we can all learn from one another to be able to do things better. Because the networks that we're using for sharing right now, this is only the first generation of them. I want you to think about the difference between a mobile. The mobile, by the way, was introduced in Australia 25 years ago this week. Remember what a mobile phone looked like 25 years ago? Think about that, and then think about an iPhone. How much more capable has it become? How much more useful? How much more essential? How transformative to culture? We share what we know, and now we're bringing sharing to bear on sharing. We're going to use sharing to transform sharing, to amplify it, to make us better sharers, to make us better learners, so that we can do more and more, which will then be fed back into the sharing to help us do more and more, which will then be fed back into the sharing to do more and more. And in the next billion seconds, we will be able to do so much that we have become nearly unrecognizable to ourselves. The people who peek at us back from 1995, they already feel a little bit old-fashioned. And soon, they're going to seem completely alien. They're not going to seem entirely human. They're going to be related, but we're going to think, they were quite all there. A friend of mine in America sent me an email this morning. He's my age. He's almost 50 years old. And he was at the office, and he was having lunch. And he was having lunch with two 23-year-olds, a 32-year-old, and himself. And the two 23-year-olds couldn't conceive of living without a mobile, that it would represent danger to them, that the thought of being cut off was absolutely not safe. The 32-year-old was reminiscing about his days in high school when he didn't have a mobile because no one had a mobile, and everything was just sort of serendipity. You just sort of ran into friends, you just sort of did things, and things just sort of happened. And he's thinking, my friend, about his life, which was mostly lived before any of this had happened, and how much things had suddenly changed.